But yet, the polar ice caps are melting. The weather events locally and globally are increasing in their frequency and severity. Oceans are rising and threatening the existence of entire islands. And soon, coastal cities, you know, are in danger. Farmers are struggling for many climate-related reasons. The global decline in bees and insects is, you know, really scary. Alarming rates of species extinction. And that's just the beginning. And I really do believe that eco-villages can help with all of that. And that in the back of my mind constantly is a reminder of why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Welcome, welcome, and welcome all to EcoVillage Library. I am Christopher Kinney, your host and the creator of EcoVillage Library. Thank you, Michael, for the tunes, and thank you all for tuning in. And in this podcast, we just get into the skinny on what it looks like to build our new society, because the one we're in right now, you know, it's just shaking up, man, and I don't know where it's going. I don't know where you know it's going. But it's the boat's rocking, you know what I mean? So why not build some life rafts meanwhile? Life rafts? Why focus on life rafts when the ship's sinking? You know, we gotta focus on keeping the ship afloat. Well, do you think people were going around saying that when Titanic hit the iceberg? You know, it's going down, and there's not enough lifeboats. But we still got time to build those lifeboats. Well, at least I hope we do still have time. And, well, not all of us know how to build lifeboats, so what do? We just get the best of the best. We put all our minds together and see what we can make. Nowadays, with in the information age, with ideas spreading like wildfire, why can't this be one of them? And you know, I never used to be a big fan of media until this really, really sunk in and realized, whoa, this could really be the tool to help perpetuate these ideas forward and get us on the right track. You know what I mean? So this brings me to my new guest to this show today. Very exciting episode. Lots of good stuff we talk about, and we'll just dive right into it and you'll hear it all yourself. I have a very interesting guest with me who is based out of Crystal Waters Ecovillage in Australia, one of the world's first permaculturally designed ecovillage. My guest today has spent a large part of his career as a photographer and regular contributor to Australia's major magazines, Nature and Health and Simply Living, before the days of computers. Now, he is an excellent documentary maker and has recently produced a documentary film about Crystal Waters Ecovillage. So our guest today is Michael Ney. And right now, Michael is working on an exciting new online magazine called Ecovillage Voice and leads an Ecovillage film festival every year promoting documentaries, interviews, and education about ecovillages all around the world. And this is barely scratching the surface, so let's just dive right in. Welcome, Michael, to Ecovillage Library, and thanks for coming on to the show.
Thanks, Christopher.
How do you like living in Crystal Water Ecovillage right now?
So living at Crystal Waters, I'm waking again to a gloriously beautiful day. The sun's shining. Freshly squeezed milk from our generous cows at my door, and the bees are buzzing loudly, and thankfully the vegetables are all still growing abundantly. I can't really see the elementals, but I am sure they're here. We really do live in a paradise at Crystal Waters with the birds, and I've got kangaroos at my back door as well as scattered around the property, and all manner of other wildlife is let loose. Also, we have a no cats or dogs policy, which makes the wildlife feel much more comfortable here. Mm.
So how's it been there, given our current situation?
Well, we generally just quietened down and you know, did isolation to a certain extent. Really, we haven't noticed that much other than missing out on gatherings on Saturday mornings for the coffee and cafe kind of time. And we have various music events quite often. So we've been missing those. But we're, like the rest of the world, have moved over to a virtual kind of thing. Our email list for the community is buzzing, and we're having online Zoom meetings for the co-op kind of dealings. But yeah, we've been very lucky in Australia, of course. And in fact, just yesterday they announced taking away some of the restrictions slowly but surely. And that's good. But, you know, it's an absolute paradise here. That's the the real thing, that the COVID virus can't really affect that.
And before this whole situation, how has it been generally living in Crystal Waters community?
Well, it's really an amazing place to be. And the community's still growing after 30 years. I mean, they've been through so much, but there are still things that are being addressed. And there's a growth period happening now with the Centre for Advanced Permaculture with Steve Cran. And generally, it's really, really quite lovely to live here. I think over the history of Crystal Waters, there's been a certain amount of conflict, which seems to be reported from various eco-villages at various times. But, you know, that's life. But it's an incredibly diverse community. That's the funny thing. And people didn't sort of sign up for any particular sort of code of conduct or belief system or anything like that. They just liked the idea of living out in the country or, you know, spending more time with nature. And that's probably one of the strongest points of the values of Crystal Waters, is the love of nature. But as the documentary shows, it is an extremely beautiful property and it's really well looked after. And there's a whole staff that, you know, work on that on a constant basis. But the actual permaculture design, I believe, was the first actual eco-village or permaculture village in the world. And yeah, it would be interesting to find out if someone wanted to counter that claim.
Was that where you originally met Bill Mollison, was during the Crystal Waters eco-village design? Or
I first arrived at Crystal Waters about, well, it's nearly 3 years now. It had been in my mind for a number of years prior to that. And even much, much longer before that, I met Bill Mollison and David Holmgren and Max Lindegger, who went on to be one of the core team of designers of Crystal Waters. I met them way back at the first permaculture conference in, I think it was 1984, I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. And I was on assignment doing photography for Simply Living for that. And I didn't know much about permaculture. In fact, it was so new that hardly anybody knew about permaculture. And, you know, getting to meet Bill and hear about all his theories and ideas and experiments and working with different properties. He was based in Tasmania, but he traveled quite a bit. And Hans Erken put that conference together, and he came and lived at Crystal Waters, one of the first residents here. Yeah, so, I mean, all of that time I was aware of Crystal Waters and somehow just kept sort of pinging, but I never managed to make it here. I got so involved in, you know, all the other things that I was doing in Sydney.
So, Michael, what was your journey like during that time then? I know you started out working with the magazine Simply Living in Nature and Health. How did your journey unfold from there?
I was introduced to all sorts of different things, and there were various festivals and various alternative health modalities, as well as permaculture people. And I shortly after that period created my own magazine and became an editor and really enjoyed the working process of contacting authors and different groups about what they were doing and everything. And that has so much given me the energy to create Eco Village Voice. And, you know, my previous work, even before that, was largely photography and photojournalism and corporate presentations. But I actually, even before that, started out in theatre. And I actually am thinking about sort of ideas around theatre and eco villages, and probably a few years down the road, may even put together some sort of a show, or it might be a traveling video show or something like that. I certainly would love to go visit a lot more eco villages and possibly, you know, with the Crystal Waters documentary, I'd love to go and make a documentary about other eco villages.
Man, sounds awesome. There'll be a whole lifetime ahead of you. Hit every single one.
Yeah, indeed.
How have you noticed your personal quality of life before living in Crystal Waters community and then after, since moving there and living there?
It's been very different, and I'm very much a city kind of guy. Lived in cities most of my life, apart from living in Bellingen for a year, which is a country area. I think it's maybe about 8 hours away from Sydney. Mm-hmm. And I also lived in Byron Bay for a year also. But, you know, they're rural communities, I guess. But Crystal Waters is a bit more remote. So being just involved in community life for me was quite different. And certainly in terms of the food quality and just the way things were done, with much more a community-minded approach, that really was very different for me. And I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I've just watched the documentary you've made, and man, it was very awesome to see just kind of all the portions of the lifestyle portrayed. And it's so different, but it just seems, you know, so right too. When you're watching, you're like, yeah, that's how I feel like a well-balanced lifestyle should be. Obviously, there'll be, you know, the problems of life or any conflicts. There'll always be wherever you go, because that's just part of life. But just watching that, especially for someone living in the cities, you know, just seems like the right thing to do. So I'm curious to know what motivated you to create that documentary in the first place.
I was asked to do it, and I'd really only just arrived at Crystal Waters a little bit before being asked. People got to know that I was a filmmaker and, you know, multimedia producer and things like that. And so we have a co-op, and they wanted to mark the 30th anniversary in some way, and they thought you know, having a film that showed all the various aspects of the community and a little bit of the history would be a really good idea. Richard Giles in particular, who's also an author and an astrologer and all sorts of natural health related things and feng shui practitioner, he in particular asked me, how do we go about doing it? And I sort of didn't realize how big a job it was actually going to be. And the original timing was meant to be, let's have it ready in about 6 months. And I got to that point and I had a certain amount, but the actual editing process is so intense. And I'd even by that time had shot so much that I wasn't able to edit a finished product in that time. So I kind of just carried on, and it took another 6 months to really come to the final product. Yeah.
Wow. A lot of work.
But yeah, I mean, I've actually lost track of how many people I interviewed, but I think it's between 50 and 70, something like that. Yeah, going around all the various aspects, as you've seen. And, you know, it's there's a lot in a big community. There's 200 people here on 600 acres. Yeah, 7 kilometers of roads.
Yeah, the most, you know, I felt very inspired, large in part, watching that documentary by all the different people you've interviewed. I think that was a big aspect of the inspiration that I felt during watching the documentary, is just the amount of awesome people that you've interviewed and the amount of experiences and knowledge they were able to share. And that was incredible. Definitely bet it was not a small undertaking. What was the feedback and receptivity of the documentary once it's been made?
Well, during the process of the documentary, in terms of the actual community members here, I would hold quite regular screenings. So even at that 6 month point, we had a bit of a screening of, you know, very fairly roughly edited kinds of things. And everyone was very enthusiastic about that. And it's very hard to stop people thinking, oh, that's the final thing. But I carried on for another 6 months doing the edit. And during that time, would have nearly monthly preview screenings as it got closer and closer and closer. Mm. And so I was getting feedback along the way of, yeah, you know, that's good, but, you know, you've forgotten this and all of that sort of thing. But, you know, generally, I think people really did like it. And it does give a comprehensive representation of the community. Within the community, though, there is this feeling like, oh, I think you painted actually just a bit too positive a picture. And, you know, they're very critical. But outside, in the real world, shall I say, the response has been fantastic. People really, really do like it.
Do you think that's a way to do it, like as a strategy of making any kind of media productions on Eco Village? You know, I've been part of examples where his project's been portrayed very, very negatively or very, very positively. Where do you think the happy medium is? Maybe right there in the middle of all that? Or what do you think in terms of the idea of Eco Villages and sustainable development becoming mainstream?
Well, I chose the road of positivity because I felt like to be negative without the positive would be very hard. As I was filming things, negative stuff did come up, and I carried on recording all of that, and I've actually started a second part of the documentary, which is called Visions and Lessons. And looking at the aspects, negative or critical, it's sort of not negative. It's just, these are the things that happen in the growth of an eco-village. Mm-hmm. And I think to ignore that is irresponsible, but to focus solely on it is equally as irresponsible, because the fact is Crystal Waters generally is a great success in terms of having a community that is living and thriving here, more or less. But where the failures or the challenges still remain in the actual use of the land in terms of producing food, and there's various issues with, you know, recycling and people owning businesses here. And I think those aspects obviously are going to take more time to resolve. But overall, I think, you know, it's certainly a fantastic place to live. All these issues are being worked on. And in terms of other filmmakers, mostly what I've seen is pretty positive. There are some sort of, I guess, specific topic kinds of videos and documentaries that look at particular issues. And that's one of the things that I will be getting to down the road. I've got a few things to do in the meantime, though.
So that would lead me to my next question of what are you working on now? What's on your plate nowadays?
Well, the Eco Village Voice has totally taken over my life. Decades ago, Crystal Waters had a magazine called The Village Voice, and nothing to do with the Village Voice that came out of New York or whatever. They probably didn't even know that existed, but it's a good name. And it was running for quite a long time. I don't exactly know how long, maybe a decade, and just put together cut and paste before computers even. But it stopped about a decade ago. And for various reasons, people left that go. But I sort of started Eco Village Voice as a newsletter / magazine for the community. But in actual fact, found there was very little kind of interest to see that happen. So I broadened the scope and made it a global kind of thing. And now it's grown into a global networking exercise, I guess. And the idea of it is to promote the idea of eco-villages and look at them as definite sustainable ways to move into the future, not making the mistakes of the past. And certainly permaculture plays a part of that. And so I'm kind of gathering information and connecting with people at various eco-villages around the world and sharing that knowledge and hoping to grow a bit of a platform. So the actual technical side of it is there's a website, ecovillagevoice.com, and it's going to be the main focal place. But out of that also comes the magazine, and I'm soon going to be releasing podcasts, and I'm doing a webinar, the first webinar with Steve Cran, the Center of Advanced Permaculture. You know, there's various membership sections or offerings. I do aim to have at least like 30 to 50% given away free, which obviously helps advertisers, and some of the key articles are released free on social media. And then, you know, basic memberships start at $6 a month, and premium members, which get everything that I produce, that's $12 a month or $120 a year. The idea is really that I want to have different aspects produced in different platforms, because people like listening to podcasts like this, mm-hmm. and people like watching videos, and some people just like reading, and some people like all of it. So I'm trying to cater for all of that. And I'll be doing blog posts, and I do a free monthly newsletter, though I actually realized I just missed the April one, so I'm going to have to catch up. And, you know, I'm really thankful now after a few months. I've got a bit of a team that's growing. And I believe you know Nicole Bradford.
Yes, yes, Nicole Bradford. Shout out if you're listening to this. Hello.
Yeah, well, she's the latest sort of member of the team. And we're going to be doing podcasts together. And she can be a host of those podcasts. And so I actually, it's not all about me. I don't want to make myself a media personality or anything like that. I'm very happy to be behind the scenes, but people like her, and I recently did a podcast with Morag Gamble, who's a fantastic permaculture teacher here, and she produces lots of videos and lots of blogs, and yeah, she's an amazing person and one of the many permaculture people obviously here, along with Robin Clayfield, who also is a teacher, more about dynamic groups. And the other team members, really, I've got a new young resident here, Ebony, who's joined as my assistant video editor, and she's also doing some article content editing. And it's great to be able to share that load, because video editing especially is extremely time consuming. And Dylan Graves, who works for Permaculture Australia, is now our kind of editor for all things relating to permaculture, and you'll see some of his offerings in the next issue. But very importantly, Diana Leaf Christian, she's a North American editor, and we've been having a great time talking online, sharing stories and bouncing ideas around. And she's the author of two books, Creating a Life Together and Practical Tools to Grow Eco-Villages and Intentional Communities. Her whole kind of thing is to help people who want to join or start their own eco-villages. So her expertise is absolutely vital for the success of Eco-Village Voice. Really, the whole way that Eco-Village Voice came about, it sort of grew over a number of months as I sort of looked at various business models and what I'm capable of doing as a, you know, long-time filmmaker and digital media producer. And I found this Japanese term called ikigai. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but something like that, which is the alignment of what you love, what the world needs, what you can be paid for, and what you're good at. And really, this kind of production, I really wish I'd started a lot earlier, but now's the time. And yeah, I'm enjoying doing it very much.
I love that. That's awesome. Yeah, it's like the I think it was another Japanese saying where like the best time to plant a tree was yesterday, but the second best time is today in regards to doing what resonates most deeply with your soul, or just doing what you said with the ikigai. You know, I think I'm sure everybody feels a sense of that, and whatever it may be for them and for them specifically. But in regards to EcoVillage Voice and getting this EcoVillage concept mainstream, what do you foresee as some of the challenges?
Well, you know, there's the commercial aspect. Obviously, I need support, and the membership is the way that I chose to do that because I'm doing so many different things. If I priced each kind of thing individually and sort of expected sales on each of those individual items, it would just be a really, really cumbersome way of getting the financial support. So I'm kind of just saying, become a member and you'll get all of this sort of stuff. And now with the global pandemic we're in, people generally aren't spending very much. So I've seen a downturn from that aspect, but hopefully that'll change fairly soon. And I think from another aspect of your question, you know, what are the barriers to spreading the concept of eco-villages? There is a sort of embedded thing where people want to be in cities because of the work. And I think if there was a shift in that kind of attitude where now it is possible to work virtually and do various other things out of the cities, obviously there will always be a need for cities. I'm not saying that the whole world's going to turn into one big eco village. Well, in a sense it is. But I think more people in the city would realize that they'd be very much happier, healthier, leading a more fulfilled life in an eco-village or an intentional community, or even within cities, there are now intentional communities forming that have permaculture gardens and whatever. So it sort of makes it like a little bit of an eco-village. And I think that definitely should be encouraged. And in terms of barriers, there are council restrictions and various ways of, you know, blocking the ownership of shared property and things like that. And I think there's an ongoing movement to ease those kinds of barriers. And it's very important that that happens. And a change in attitude from the government and council level needs to occur. And also the same thing's happening with the tiny house, tiny homes movement. There's a big article in the next issue of EcoVillage Voice.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this actually for the past couple of days of this ever-increasing urbanization of the world and life being kind of sucked dry from the rural countrysides, and how to, you know, see the reversal, or in other words, creating eco-villages. And would you agree that it would take equal parts loosened regulations and change in attitude in the government as well as grassroots initiatives? Do you think it's a 50-50 effort?
Well, I don't know about 50-50, but I think there's definitely an attitude change from both ends, like the people realizing that it's actually very possible and viable for people to create eco-villages and to be happy and healthy, you know. That I really think is the key thing. Once, if there's enough people wanting it to happen, then the government and the councils will fall into place and they'll see, okay, well, we don't need to block that. Most of it's to do with, you know, safety issues and just, you know, privacy and all sorts of roads and, you know, all of those kinds of things. None of it's hard to solve, really. I think where there's a will, there's a way.
100%. And you've just mentioned, you know, your issue about the tiny homes, and I'm kind of curious, what do you see going on? What do you see this developing into or evolving into? Because just now recently, I've just been having conversations with local governments here about having legal tiny homes, but it's just not understood and it's still deemed very illegal. So, you know, in this part of the world, or at least where I'm, you know, pessimism could easily creep in. So what do you see as a whole of just this whole thing going forward, looking ahead?
Seems to me that tiny housing is a movement that is definitely starting to grow, and people want cheaper ways of finding their home. They also want them to be mobile, and tiny houses on wheels in particular helps with that. And they really could play an important role in helping reintegrate people into a more functional living. And, you know, it creates this affordable housing while also, importantly, reducing the footprint on the environment. And it also encourages much more minimalistic living. And I think that's the key thing with cities in general. It's just very wasteful. And addressing that in a very focused kind of manner would be really good. And tiny houses and eco-villages in particular really do address that. Also, there's a number of reasons people fall in love with tiny houses, like the actual downsizing from their great big mansion, and especially older people, I guess, though not necessarily. Having less possessions is good, and it's much more affordable and reduces maintenance and much easier for transportation kinds of things. Like if you want to spend time, you know, near a beach or something like that, you can take your entire house and just live there for a while. And, you know, caravan parks sort of starting to morph into tiny house villages, I guess. Yeah.
Totally. And I just also personally just love how it feels too. You know, just feels, you know, something about it just more primal. You're just kind of in a, you know, just a very personalized home, you know. It's hard to explain, but it does definitely feels right. Now, I'm curious to note also a little bit more about what you also have been working on with the Eco Village Film Festival. Is that happening this year, do you think?
Definitely. Because I'm a filmmaker, obviously, I want to be involved in things like that. And I thought, you know, what a great way to promote both Eco Villages and get people to know about Eco Village Voice than to hold a film festival. And so I started to research and see what was available. And there's an awful lot. So November last year, we had the first Eco Village Film Festival in our local town in Mullaney. You know, it was very well received. What I'm looking to do now, obviously, is make it an online film festival. So I'm actually going to repeat the same program that was held last year in an online fashion for a global audience, rather than just our local audience. And we'll see how that goes. And from that point, maybe later in the year, October, November, have another one where I'll be calling for filmmakers around the world to submit their films. And it can be all sorts of different kinds of films. And there's an article again in the next issue of Eco Village Voice that actually does that invitation. So I'm hoping that a lot of filmmakers will come, but there's also quite a bank of previously produced films, and they're pretty good. And we had ones from Dam and Her, and I showed the Crystal Waters documentary and numerous others, and Diana Christian Leaf also. I put in a lecture of hers about eco villages. So it's an educational event, really. It furthers the idea of eco villages being a worthwhile thing to pursue and do more of.
Mm-hmm. And I know too, like, you know, I'll go into Google Trends and you put in eco villages, and it still seems that, you know, not too many people are entering that into their Google searches, but I'm sure this is quickly changing. What do you foresee the trend in that? Do you see people Google searching eco villages and just having it become more of an item of curiosity for the general public as we progress through time?
I think so. The idea of eco villages is definitely spreading, and as with permaculture as well. Permaculture has gone through a bit of a revolution in the last year or two as well, where it's broadening out into urban situations, and backyard gardens are now becoming permaculture gardens and things like that. And it's a similar thing with eco villages, where people realize, well, yeah, look, you know, we've got three houses in a row here. Actually, if we tore down our fences and made a great big garden and shared the food and things like that, and, you know, that is happening. I think that's really exciting. It's really just a matter of keeping on talking about it and spreading the idea and showing viable possibilities and examples. And there's so many different ways of both financing and forming an eco village. And we've got a new eco village that is now 1 year old in Mullaney, and I'll be doing a podcast with them fairly soon too. And they have devised a particular financial model that they're hoping to spread around Australia to begin with and might spread around the world, but it's a very viable kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm very curious. I'm very interested to see what economic model they're designing there.
Yeah, you can find out about the Eco Village financial model that was recently started at in our town here called Mullaney. It's on a website called ecovillages.com.au. And Claire Ogden and Andrew McLean, they started their Eco Village a year ago, and it's growing quite well. You know, I visited them the other day, and more buildings are happening, and there's half a dozen people living there now, and they're sort of gathering a bit of momentum. And I think it's great that underlying what they're doing in a grounded physical fashion is being spread as an idea of like, okay, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are some challenges you need to get through, but we have some solutions, and have a look at this. And they're not, you know, stipulating that everyone has to strictly abide by all of the rules or whatever. It's just kind of a proposal, and it addresses some of the barriers in government and council and things like that too.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not too familiar either with the Australian environment. Is it pretty conducive for the development of eco-villages? Is it fairly simple or easy to get an eco-village project going in Australia?
That's kind of a hard question to answer. It seems to be okay, and people are doing it. And I haven't been on the sort of leading edge of that, so I don't really know the struggle that goes on. It's one of the things I want to research a bit more of. Mm-hmm. But we have quite a lot of eco-villages in Australia already. I'm not exactly sure of the number, but it might be 30 or more, which is, you know, for our population, that's pretty good.
Yeah, quite significant.
Yeah. I mean, Global Eco Village Network maintains currently an estimated 15,000 eco villages across 6 continents.
Wow.
And I think Global Eco Village Network, their organization, has signed up about 6,000 people around the world. And, you know, you've got to be careful about how you actually define an eco village. And the GEN website has some articles about all of that. Mm. And just reading further, this is from EcoLease. I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. Eco-villages have some of the lowest carbon footprints on the planet. Studies of carbon dioxide emissions in Danish eco-villages find they are 60% lower than the national average. And German eco-villages are 35% of the national average. The Irish eco-village in Clough, Jordan, probably pronounced that wrong, has the lowest measured eco footprint in Ireland, and Findhorn Eco Village in Scotland has the lowest documented ecological footprint of any settlement in the industrial world.
And that is using the ecological footprint methodology?
Yeah. And, you know, that's as good a way to judge anything in terms of success of why you would form an eco-village. There's many other reasons, of course.
Yeah, I know when I was working with Kalayala in Panama, one of the biggest things was to be able to measure its own sustainability, and being responsible and in charge of that, I found the ecological footprint methodology as the surest indicator, as you just mentioned, with all these eco-villages in Europe using it as their tracker and measuring their own sustainability. I found it very fascinating, you know, the calculations and what all goes into the methodology. It's very fascinating, very illuminating, and as that compares to the national averages.
It is, yeah. And I would imagine your listeners, and you've probably even interviewed people from the Global Eco-Village Network, but it was set up in 1995 to support the experimental creation and preservation of human settlements that not only sustain but regenerate their social and natural environments. And Eco-Village Voice has 3 keywords that I use to see whether an article or activity is kind of in place. And that is obviously eco-village and regeneration and community. Mm. And those three things are my, I guess, backbone of the, what the publishing's all about. Yeah, I've also been working with some of the people from Global Eco-Village Network, like Trudy Durians, and she was a speaker at the first Eco-Village Film Festival.
Okay.
And has been very... Yeah, she's been very supportive of what I've been doing, and I hope to actually involve the Global Eco-Village Network more in the future.
Yeah, fantastic organization. That's where I first got my big, like, in-depth introduction doing the EDE design course, or the Applied Eco-Village design course in Finhorn. And that was just the rabbit hole for me. And the organization, Global Eco-Village Network and Gaia Education, has been always my backbone go-to whenever I have doubts with any kind of questions in regards to the development of eco-villages.
Yeah, sure. And I've only recently connected with Christian Weil, and there's going to be an article by him relating to the pandemic. And I'm yet to make personal contact with May East from Gaia Education, but I also hope to involve them.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's great. So what's on the horizon now for you? Like, what do you hope to see and envision, or what do you envision for yourself for Eco-Village Voice, you know, 1 year down the road, a couple of years down the road?
Well, I hope the membership grows, and that will allow me to, you know, publish more and more. Like, as I get more team members, I can spread the load a little bit further. But right now I'm in the thick of designing the next issue, which will be out in a week or so. I'm also editing some podcasts that have been recorded. I'm preparing a webinar with Steve Cran for the Center for Advanced Permaculture. And that's very exciting too, because it's a very media-rich thing. We've actually shot some videos to go into the webinar, and I'm preparing some ebook kinds of things to go with it as well.
So it'd be like educational webinars?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
So his whole thing is preparing for climate change, and it's very down to earth and practical. And he's creating a massive garden at Crystal Waters and involving various community people in that, in, you know, a small way to start with. It's obviously going to grow. And then there'll be, once we can gather again after the pandemic, there's going to be a number of different courses on different aspects of, you know, creating your own garden. Yeah.
Wow. Excited. Now, how can people get in touch with you? What is the best place to find out what you're up to and, you know, get subscribed with Eco-Village Voice? Where is a good go-to?
I'll send you a whole lot of links for the show notes, but ecovillagevoice.com is the very first port of call. And through there, you can find my email address and social media contacts. And I'm sort of spreading across Twitter and Facebook at the moment. I soon also will be publishing free articles on Medium. And the website will also have a number of free articles, but you can join to become a member and actually get the magazine in a viewable sort of designed fashion rather than a website version. I think we'll be doing a lot more teleconference meetings also in as time goes on. And that's going to be really exciting.
Awesome. And last question, that, you know, I've always been trying to do this trademark question. If you were to be any animal in the world, what would you be and why?
Probably a dolphin.
Oh, interesting. Why do you say that?
Why? Well, I hear they have a very good sex life. they also have, you know, an abundance of food. They're also very sort of social creatures, and they seem to have a lot of fun.
Yeah, nice. You know, I've been very, very interested with everybody's responses to this question. It's very, very interesting. Everyone has the most interesting responses.
What other ones have you had?
Oh, my last one I did for my Spanish version of the podcast, Biblioteca Ecuadoriana, He said a hummingbird because he mentioned like a story about a hummingbird, you know, putting out a fire with its beak. And then, you know, all the other animals asking, you know, why are you doing that when you're just like a hummingbird? It's just, oh, just doing my part, what I could do within my means or something like that. So he based his off of this, you know, story. And he's, you know, I'm assuming maybe from Colombia or something where he's from. But and another ones were... you know, birds, jellyfish, all across the board. So
cool, yeah.
So hopefully we get the word out, Michael, and get everybody more tuned in with the idea of eco-villages. And, you know, on all across the board, it just seems the most appropriate solution at this point where we are in human history. My intellect and philosophical inquiries are always leading me to the singular answer of just, you know, it's got to be this, you know, this, I just don't see it any other way. Hunkering down into small ecologically regenerative communities just seems to be the most commonsensical solution to all of this.
Absolutely. I think regeneration, as you mentioned, is very, very a key aspect to the whole thing.
All right, Michael. Well, I guess that wraps up all my questions for you. And well, yeah, stay safe out there and we'll keep in touch.
Okay, indeed. And thank you very much for, you know, having me on your podcast platform, and I hope that grows. And I'll certainly be putting various links to some of your previous podcasts in the magazine too.
Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Well, there you have it, folks. That was Michael Ney for you. Excellent, excellent, excellent human being, and has a lot to offer. So please show him some of your love. Go visit Eco Village Voice and visit the links in the description below, and definitely check out his documentary if you can. Very, very, very well done piece of work. And well, that's about it. And don't forget to please leave a review for this episode of whichever platform you've listened to it on. It helps the show a lot. And well, much love until next time. Ciao, ciao.